things I used to do, I don't do no more. Things I used to do, I don't do no more. For the Lord's made a change in me.
Hello, this is Real History. I am Melissa. Today is Thursday, the 28th of November. It is the American Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And I will be putting this up bright and early Thursday morning. And then I will go into the kitchen where I plan to reheat what I intend to have made on Wednesday, which is mushroom dressing, mushroom gravy, and a pecan pie. And I'm going to mix it up a little bit this year with the pecan pie and put chocolate in it, which I've done before. I take the shell and then I line it with some chocolate. And this time I'm going way over the top and I'm just going to grate chocolate all through there. And then when it comes out of the oven, I'm going to put more chocolate on it and a little bit of sea salt. Doesn't that sound good? I just kind of made it up in my head today, and I think it'll be good. So how are you, Suzanne?
I'm really good. So nice to see you.
It is nice to see you, too. We have spoken but not seen each other, and yet I had a pretty strong visual, and it turned out to be accurate. So, yeah.
Well,
can we start with your scarf?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I do natural plant dyeing. So I take natural plant dyeing is a lot different than synthetic dyeing. So you have to use, obviously, natural fibers. So it's like a three-step process. You have to boil your scarf and remove all of the, like a lot of sewing machines give oil, right? So you want to get rid of all the oil from the fabric, strip it of all of its, you know, toxins. And then you would boil it again in a tannin, which is like a tea. And then you boil it a third time in a mordant, and then you hang it to dry. And then I use cochineal. And
tell us what cochineal is.
Well, cochineal is those little bugs that hang around the cacti. They're very stinky. And they produce the most beautiful pink. And you can actually shift it to red by adding iron. And then I also do a thing called eco printing. So I mix the color with plants. So yeah, so this one, you can see it has sumac leaves on it. I don't know if you can see that, but
yes, yeah. Hold it steady.
Marigolds.
Okay.
And it's quite a process. I mean, obviously, it's a labor of love. You're not going to become a millionaire making these, but it's very time consuming. So once I've done, you know, the preparation, then you would take, you would collect your leaves. You have to find leaves that have tannin. So things like sumac, eucalyptus, marigolds, you know, lots of flowers have tannins. And then I create like these paints with like iron, vinegar, a few other ingredients. You paint each leaf and then you place it on your garment. You fold it and then you wrap it around a pole. And then you would boil it for a good hour. And then you're always surprised. It's like a Christmas, you know, you open up your roll and you don't know what you're going to get. Yeah.
So what kind of a pot are you boiling it? It's on a pole. How big is the pot?
My whole backyard is, you know, like a hillbilly backyard. So I've got this big gas stove in the backyard. And then my pots are about 20 liters of water, even more. And then you just, have these things boiling all summer long. Probably the neighbors are, you know, it stinks like the cochineal. Not all dyes stink, but the cochineal really smells bad. So I'm sure the neighbors can get a whiff of that stuff and wondering what's going on. I have a small business where I make clothing. Mostly I use a lot of hemp. I use organic cottons. This is modal, which is beechwood, which is a rayon. You know, it's not quite as organic as hemp. And hemp is part cell, really, because it's a little bit scratchy, but it softens, obviously, when you wash it. But, So, yeah.
So, Suzanne, we didn't even say where you're from, but Suzanne sent me a few beautiful things, and one of them was the hemp. I should have had them all here prepared to show for show and tell. I didn't, but I love that hemp. It is scratchy. I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it fits like a glove. And how you got that one figured out, I don't know. But it's really sharp and snappy. And the scrunchy thing too. I'm like, oh, what a revelation! Yeah, a hair scrunchy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Your business. Do you want to say what that is?
Yeah, I'm Funky Buddha Collection, but the Buddha, you know, I mean, so I'll just tell you how I got the name. So I used to travel a lot. You know, I was kind of 25 years sort of out of Canada. I spent a lot of time in Asia, and in Nepal, they had this restaurant called Funky Buddha. And back in the day, my partner and I opened a small business. The store was called Funky Buddha. We liked the name, and I liked, you know, because I was sort of connected to Japan and not really into so much Buddhism, but anyhow, because we imported, it sort of
made... You liked the name. So yeah. How long, you were in Japan, you said, for a long time.
Yeah, a decade. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Teaching English, though, mostly teaching English. I lived in Kansai, which is near Osaka. Well, actually, Kansai is Osaka. Osaka, Kobe, Kyoto, Nara. I lived in many different places. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And loved Japan, loved Japanese people, miss it a lot. I learned a lot there. I learned a lot. Not so much the language, but the cooking. I love Japanese cooking. I love flower arrangement, even though I don't really do it, but I did some martial arts. I did study a bit of Buddhism, especially Japanese tea ceremony, which is a lot of sitting and sweets. And, you know, it's kind of all Zen, you know, it's all about.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the tea ceremony? Because I think that the idea there are all these different traditions in the world. And when you're talking about some of them, what you're talking about is a set of practices that are designed to bring you into a higher state of consciousness. They are to clear your mind of the common and the mundane. And yet the tea ceremony is interesting because you're doing something rather mundane. You're making and serving tea, but it's the way in which it's done that is so conscious of each action and each step that it is a form of meditation. So if you want to share a little bit of that, I think that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I'm a Gaijing. I'm an alien there. It's
yes. I actually know what a Gaijing yeah. is. Yeah, so I read James Clavell.
Oh, yes. So, and of course, you know, I was there in the 90s, and they really loved me because I was very genki, which is enthusiastic. So always the women wanted to include me into something. So the tea ceremony came like that. It wasn't because I'm looking for, you know, but anyhow. So tea ceremony is a lot of sitting, okay? And you're sitting in a special way. You're not necessarily cross-legged. Sometimes you're on your knees. And as a foreigner, you know, we're not used to sitting on the ground, especially in the early days when I first arrived there. So essentially, you get beautiful to go to the ceremony. So often you will wear a kimono. So my friends would often dress me in a nice kimono. And the vessel that it's served in, the cup, is very important. It's all about the cup and how beautiful the cup is. And obviously, so the boiling of the water, it's going into the pot, and then, you know, they get the matcha and the whisk, and they whisk it. And then it's passed each person. You're usually in a circle, and there's sweets. You always have those Japanese soybean. Mm-hmm. I think they're not. They're not soybean. They're azuki bean, I think, the sweet bean.
Azuki. It's a red bean.
It's a red bean, yeah. And and they're beautiful. The desserts, they're very soft, and so you'll have this, you know, little small platter of these desserts, and then when the cup is coming to you, you appreciate the cup. You look at the tea. You'll turn the cup around, and then you'll take your sip, and then pass it to the next lady, and then so on. Yeah. So it's really about. I never really got into the aspect of the higher consciousness. For me, it was really about those sweets and the tea. It was all about the sweets. I was always about my stomach, not, you know, so you know. And also, it was excruciating because they don't. It's not an hour. We're talking 3 or 4 hours sitting, right? It's a long time. So,
what takes up the time of it?
Just the politeness and the calmness. It's so long ago. I just remember it was kind of excruciating, but you sit there and you smile and you know, cause I was young, a lot younger than I am now. I could handle it. And,
Was there conversation?
Okay. Yes, a lot of conversation. You know, it's interesting. I don't really remember. I just remember those sweets and
the Suzanne, bowl. That's hilarious.
And I remember everywhere in Japan, there's a window and like a clear glass window, and you see these sweets, and you know they're really only meant for tea ceremony, but mm-hmm. Gaijings used to eat them,
very funny.
Yeah, it was fun. It really
so
was.
You're in Canada. We got that from the story, and you are from Toronto. Well, actually Ontario. And
I'm from, okay, so I live in Peterborough.
Okay.
But right now I'm in Collingwood, which is the Blue Mountains. You might have known it. It's Blue Mountain. So my mother lives up here. So I'm staying.
You're in your mother's house.
I'm in my mother's house. That's why you can see all these little plates. And
You know, that's very funny, Suzanne, because I'm in my mother's house and it's still very much her house. I have a few things here and there, but I just leave it that way because it's fine. And she had plates. It's something of our time, you know, more or less. I think you're younger than I am, but I think it's more or less that age. Our mothers collected plates.
They did. And they collected many things.
Yes.
I've now had some relatives pass. And because like the Royal Daltons, you know, they thought this would be valuable. Yeah. Some of them are, but mostly they're not. Those little Himmels, because my mother is Austrian. So, you know, those little tiny Himmels.
Yes.
But I love all those women and I love all their knickknacks. I mean, I'm not the younger generation. No, they don't want any of that stuff, you know.
No, which is so sad because it's just full of, you know, life and family and memory and experiences. And, you know, my mother hand painted china when she was younger. She got into that. And so some of her plates are from places that they traveled. And I look on the wall and I go, you know, I remember that we were in Romania. I was very young, but, and there was the plate on the wall from Poland. And there's the plate that she got in Scotland. Mom and Dad went to Scotland. I've never been, you know, really envious of that. But she painted beautiful china plates with roses and leaves. And it's just so elegant and amazing. And
beautiful.
And it's not just that young people don't collect these things or they're not interested in it. They're not even interested in the family heritage or the story behind it. None of that. Nor do they have the attention span for even doing what you're doing with like dying. I mean, have you noticed that? I know we're a couple of people talking about those young kids, but it's true.
I just love the children. I can't tell you how much I do, but it does sort of break my little heart a little bit, their lack of sentimental value in their history, you know? So I find most of the young people, because I have a 28-year-old son and I have an 18-year-old daughter and I have obviously extended, right? Like my husband or partner, he's got a beautiful daughter who's 30. So I have a couple of step grandchildren, you know, and I love them. Don't get me wrong, but they like the whole minimalist beige. Everything has got to be kind of clean. Nothing on the walls or very little things on the walls. I prefer like a museum, lots of things. You know, I'm a bit of a slob, but yeah. It's there's many things going on now with our kids that I can't necessarily comprehend, but I know they're being influenced. There's no doubt in my mind by social media. They're not looking to their elders for advice. Mm-hmm. And I even feel the ageism because I still go out. I still like to celebrate. And I'm usually the oldest person celebrating. I don't often see people on the dance floor my age, you know. But sometimes you feel the ageism and it's kind of strange because, you know, I'm sure you also feel 18 inside, but, you know, you do get older and wrinkles and, you know, but there's not the same level of respect anymore, like our generation, that I really want to encourage young people to seek advice from their mothers and their fathers or their aunts. Because we've already experienced many things. And when we're gone, that experience goes with us. And you can't get that in a book, especially if a book is written by someone who's young or else there's something in it for them. Not quite sure what, but you know, a lot of these books become sort of bestsellers. And then these younger people read them. And they don't know where the information came from, you know, especially the feeding now of the children. I know this is one of my pet peeves. You probably haven't seen this, but they're not mushing the baby food anymore. The babies now are eating themselves. And so if you ever look, because you're not part of Facebook or Instagram, you'll see, you know, a spaghetti face. They're given hard food and they're putting it in their mouth. They're not. No. I mean, if it was just one person, I'd say, okay, it's just one person. But no, I was at a shower recently. It's all of the mothers, all of them. And they read this thing, it's called baby weaning or baby letting, like letting the baby feed himself, essentially. And it's almost like we're heading towards baby rights. You know how we have children rights, now we have baby rights. And it's very strange, let them feed what they want. But then I read also that there's more constipation with the babies because they're eating these hard things.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and I talked to some other parents, like grandparents, and one father said that his daughter gave him a page this long of all the things to do that they want done for their own baby. And the father said, I'm not reading that, you know. And he was so worried because these kids are, they're like 6 months and they're chewing on hard food. And sometimes they start to gag.
Yes.
And they're gonna choke. But anyway, that's just
I have to tell you something. One thing that I make, I haven't actually made it since Alan passed away. No, that's not true. I made it for someone and said this was one of Alan's favorites, which are fish cakes.
I love fish cakes.
So, and you can do it anyway. You can do it with fish that you cooked fresh, or you can do it with tinned fish. It doesn't matter. But what you do is you take the fish and you crumble it up, and then you you can have leftover mashed potatoes, or you can cook, if it's just two of you, you can cook a little potato and then mash it up. And then you put some seasonings, whatever. You could chop up a little onion. I mean, in other words, the sky's the limit with it. And then you can bread it, or you don't have to, and then fry it in a pan. And they're just great. And he loved them. He loved them when I made it. But one time he was in the kitchen. He passed through and he was watching me carefully, like a sushi chef or something, picking through the meat to make sure there were no small bones in there, you know, and I'm picking. And he told me that the Eskimo mothers, the women that he had read or heard or seen somehow, that the Eskimo mothers would take the fish that they were going to feed their babies,
yeah.
their toddlers, and they would chew it up. They would masticate it for them, and they would make sure there was no bone in there whatsoever. It was all perfectly soft, chewable, and everything. And then they would remove it from their mouth and give it to their baby. And he was immensely impressed by that level of care. You know, it can sound kind of disgusting, but, you know, he said that is a mother who cares what goes in her baby's mouth.
You know, I know about that, Melissa, because
do you?
And also the saliva from the mother creates enzymes in the food.
Ooh.
And that enzyme is passed on to the baby. And I've been all over the world. I mean, I haven't been to Africa. Okay, I haven't been. I've been mostly Southeast Asia, but every culture, Japanese, Indian, Thai, they all mash it and they will take it in their hand and feed their baby. You know, but now it's almost like, don't, please, girls out there who are listening, who are doing this, it's fine. I'm not judging. Maybe this is better than the way that we've done it for thousands of years. You know, I don't know. It could be, but I don't get it. They all know I don't. I always question them every time I see them. They can justify it. It's only because I love you. But yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Well, I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, new things. And I think Dr. Spock was famous for things that simply didn't work. I mean, that he probably was the first. And was he back in the 50s or 60s? You know, huge on how the mothers have to do it. And this is one thing. Was it Bertrand Russell? I don't remember now. I think. Who wrote in one of his books that you'd have to consult the expert on, you know, how to take care of your baby, which is instinctual.
Yeah, it's true.
It's instinctual.
It's so instinctual. I mean, because
I don't know because I don't have children, but I'm thinking it's instinctual.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, nursing, of course, is the number one thing I think is very important. And a lot of girls are doing that. So bless them for doing that because it's hard work to nurse. My mother's generation, we were all bottle fed because they hijacked them in the hospitals, kept them in there for 7 days, told them that they had no milk. And by the time they left, there was no milk if you don't feed your baby. And they forced the whole formula for the children. So, you know, I just worry that I hope this isn't the same thing with this new way of feeding babies, that they're kind of hijacking a tradition of women that's passed on from mother to daughter, that I would like to keep going. But what do I know? I'm not an expert. that's all. And my kids are healthy. And all I know is that whatever I read, to prevent asthma from being passed on, it's really important that your children are breastfed, you know, and obviously not immunized. That's my take on it because, you know, you're born perfect. Your body is your church, your temple. You need to protect it from any kind of outside things. Should be natural, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, too, about the clothing and why I've chosen hemp and organic, because we were talking about yoga the other day, and I've been into yoga since I was 18. I'm now almost 60. And I always thought you have to have cottons and natural clothing to do it. And then because I'm in the fashion world, and you may not have followed this, but there was this whole movement back about I don't know, 5-6 years ago with these plastic bottle pants. Did you ever hear about it, Melissa?
No.
Okay. Well, and I never, I always thought, because I didn't know about the United Nations then, but I kept hearing this word sustainable. And I kept thinking sustainable is organic. Sustainable is organic farming. And so they kept calling these. So what they did was they could make 500 plastic bottles to make one pair of yoga pants, you know, the stretchy synthetic ones. They're recycled. They're recycling the plastic. And I kept thinking, but but that's not organic. And then Lululemon came
out. Well, it's also that you might be getting warm and warm. I mean, you're wearing plastic.
Yeah.
Just think about that.
I know.
You're wearing plastic.
Yeah. And also all the research points towards fertility problems if you're wearing plastic bottles. And I just didn't get it. And of course, they had the most beautiful images because you can make prints on plastic. It's perfect printing. And I was always a little jealous because, you know, I mean, hemp, I thought, okay, I'll do the plant dyeing. You know, I go so far with wanting to be clean, my body clean, my clothing clean, and yoga clean. But it's like a dialectic, you know, it is a kind of telling you that it's sustainable, yet giving you something toxic in return. And not to mention the re-emittance of the plastics into the atmosphere. It doesn't make any sense. That's not sustainable. That's toxic.
Well, there have been so many good exposés, and frankly, even in the mainstream, but there are also alternative people who have shown that there is nothing sustainable about sustainability, that if you look closely at the green thing, I mean, just take, for instance, an obvious one, which would be electric vehicles, EVs. The decimation of indigenous cultures so that you can go down and mine cobalt, the decimation of the culture alone, what is being done to the environment when they do that kind of mining, the infrastructure that it takes to charge the battery. I mean, that's just one scam. If you look at the windmills, you're going to come up with the same thing. One time we were in, you know, at home, and the railroad went right by us. The train went right by, and they were hauling broken propellers.
Oh,
broken down propellers. We figured out that was what was going by, and you know, just kind of filed that one away. Well, we were actually driving one day and saw the same thing going by on tractor trailers. You know, this was probably a year later. So I start researching it and I find you can't get rid of those. You can't recycle them. They try to bury them. They never disintegrate. I mean, same thing with solar panels. It's like every single thing that they tell us is sustainable is far from it. So it's such a scam.
It is.
It's, you know, such a scam.
Recently, there was this horror story as well. I mean, these electric cars, supposedly, I don't know if I have been in one before, but they lock from the inside out. So as soon as you get in the car and you're driving, the doors lock. And there was an accident in Toronto about, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago. And the poor children hit something. The car exploded, and they couldn't get out of the car. That's right. So these things lock from the inside. And actually, to be honest, who wants that for anyone? You know, they say now people are buying for inside the car something to break the window. I mean, how is that safe? And how did it go through the safety checks? Because I don't think they do safety checks anymore. I don't think they really care. I think they just want to push their whole fake future of electric without any consciousness. I mean, making it's dangerous. They're actually dangerous to drive. They're not just horrible for the environment. They're actually dangerous for the driver and the people inside the car, you know, and those kill switches too, that they're now going to be putting on all the vehicles, you know, that they say, oh, it's because of theft. Because actually, I know people, some wealthy people with wealthy, expensive cars. And my girlfriend said on her street alone, these cars are being stolen regularly on one street. You know, a very wealthy street full of, you know, $150,000 cars, you know, these people come in and steal them. But I kind of think it ties into their whole kill switch idea. And what is, like, who leaves your $150,000 car unsafe, right, in your driveway?
Right.
When you know that it could be stolen. I mean, your insurance is going to cover it, but then it ties into the agenda of now, I want a kill switch because I don't want my car to be stolen. But it's actually, there's more to that than than just finding it and whoever steals it, turning it off.
Well, of course, I mean, they showed that in a very humorous way in the movie Idiocracy, when someone had, you know, some offense, and so the cops were looking for him, and all they had to do was the killage.
Yeah.
So the car just stops where it is. You can't go further. And with GPS and everything, I mean, it's pretty obvious where they're going. It's, you're not driving. You know? We know where you are. We're coming for you. And your car has just stopped. So
Yes. We know exactly where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, which brings you to the whole tracking, too, and people tracking each other now, like wives having their husband's phone location, you know. And I said, I don't want to track my partner. I mean, he has to have some privacy. And tracking your children, well, there has to be trust, you know. I mean, but I don't know what world we live in anymore, but I like my privacy. And now, of course, there are cameras everywhere. Before 10 years ago, I think, I can't remember which premier put the cameras up, and there were so many complaints that they took them down. But now people are soft. They're not noticing. They don't look up and they don't look forward. But slowly they've been putting all these, they call them, they're just to collect data. They're not to check for your speeding.
But oh, right.
Do you want to have your data collected?
Yeah.
Do you want someone to know where you're going all day long?
Yeah.
You know, I don't.
Two questions. Okay. What prompted you? Obviously, the traveling and the, you know, you've had a bit of, I won't call it wanderlust, but you're curious. But what prompted you to question things on a little bit deeper level, and how did that lead you to discovering Alan Watts' work? And when did that happen?
Oh, okay. You know, I think I've always known. I've known a long time, because I think I told you when I was 4 years old, my father had a terrible accident. He fell from a ladder. It took 6 months for him to become paralyzed. They took him to a hospital in Oshawa. They let him sit there for 10 days while his spinal cord died. And then they finally, you know, airlifted him to Toronto, where he had a surgery, and the doctor said he couldn't believe it, that he'd been left unattended while he was paralyzed from the waist down. So that changed my whole family. I mean, I was four, my brother was four, and my sister was a baby. And my mother, you know, had to suddenly become the breadwinner, you know, and also just the way the work and compensation worked, you know, and just being asthmatic as well. So I was never so hypnotized by school, because I was always sick. And so I missed a lot of school, and also put on a lot of high drugs, and you have kind of ADHD. You can't think when you're on steroids, or, you know. And then it was also at the end of my university, I met some guys that were alternative. They didn't believe in the government, you know. I don't know, you know, it was the 80s. And then I kept leaving Canada, you know. I think the first trip I did was after I graduated. I spent a year in Australia. I would come back. And every time I would come back, I would notice, why doesn't anybody have a full-time job? Why are they only on contracts? You know, there were no more jobs. And I started to see more and more that that all of the manufacturing was going offshore. And I remember when that first bush blew up, that poor country. And I remember being in a bar in Japan, and there were a lot of Americans, and I said, how can they do that, you know? And they mm-hmm. were for it. Then I said, like, how can you be for murder or war? And you know, I mean, and my dad, of course, because my dad had chronic pain. He was always alternative. So he was into organic farming. He was into yoga because he wanted to find a way out of pain. And he always knew about Monsanto and the orange, Agent Orange. And he said to me as a young child and to my brother and to my sister, we have to stop Monsanto. And that's, we're talking 40 years ago, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you already know that there's something wrong, that something is happening, then you kind of are awake. And mm-hmm. then I became friends with some chiropractors, and they were the ones that kind of said, don't vaccinate your baby, you know, don't vaccinate your kids. I mean, my son had two vaccines because I thought he needs the polio vaccine. You know, we went to India, but he only had two, but my daughter's had none. And mm-hmm. I want to keep it that way, you know, but it's hard. Because there's always, she's in school, and there's this peer pressure and this kind of, it's normal to be poisoned by your government.
Now, you said that she was pretty strong against that so far.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she is.
Because of your input. So
She is. But you don't know. For how long, you know, because maybe her job will require it, maybe somewhere down the line. But the interesting thing about how I discovered Alan Watt is I'd already gone down the theosophy route. And in fact, I met that group in India. They're everywhere, you know, that. Yeah. And if you're right about the books, the publication of books, because you could find books there. Of course, Alan Watt with no S. There's all his books there, Krishnamurti.
You mean Watts with the S.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I know. No, it's the
S, okay. So yeah. I was going, and I can't stand that guy, okay? I was going down his rabbit hole, you know, trying to dig up more stuff on him. And then this guy, Alan Watt, turned up, right? Alan. And I heard his voice. And I couldn't believe it, Melissa. I said, it was almost like I could hear my father. It's just soft-spoken, intelligent, true, honest. Everything he said made sense. It all put everything that I kind of already knew into a beautiful language that was just so soothing and so precious to me. I wish I had have known him. But I can say I love Alan. I love him because there are very few honest people that speak the truth in a beautiful way, you know? So, yeah.
That's great. So yeah. when did you find him?
Well, how long? When was the first email I sent you? Not that long. Maybe less than 2 years, for sure. But I've listened to every show that's on there, all of them, like all the ones in the back. And many times, if I can't sleep, I put him on low, you know, he soothes me and I can fall asleep. Because what I love about yours is you put it on and the screen goes black. So it's just like a story. And because sometimes I can't sleep and he helps me sleep. Yeah.
That's great.
You were very lucky to have spent time with him.
Yes.
To continue his work. Yeah. Which I've tried to get everyone to listen, you know, but it's not for everybody.
No. No, yeah. I think there's a talk that's going to go up soon. There's someone who actually volunteered to do the Christmas show.
Oh, nice.
To make a video. So I don't want to say too much about it, but I was listening to that and what he said was, it's just a beautiful, it was one of his Christmas messages. And he said quite clearly this isn't for everyone, and not everyone is going to get it. Not everyone is going to wake up. Not every, you know, sometimes I would become very early on when I was with him, very sad for the state of humanity, for the human condition, for all of the suffering in the world. And he was hard about that. You know, he said, you can't cry for the casualties. You can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. disabling. You just have to, they're casualties. And his thinking about that is that this is an agenda run by a deviant class, a deviant priesthood, he called them, that is so old, much older than we probably even know about. You know, he would always say, we're so much older than we acknowledge, than we think we are. And this has been around forever. And the techniques of mind control, the techniques of controlling populace through whatever, and everything is included in that. You know, it's food, it's medicine, it's religion, it's your education. So there's a lot of casualties. And he said it has always been that way. The people who seek truth, they're not that many.
No.
But there are enough that humanity continues on.
It's true. You know, I spent a lot of time in India, and I was really into psytrance and techno. And there's a place in India where it's the Mecca, you know. I mean, I don't know if it is still going on. But what's interesting about this place is that there are tribes. So you've got your Italians, your French, your English, every single nationality in their groups are there. And so you see the world in that place, you know. You see also, it's not good. And also, I am so sure that they're watching that group because
they're
watching it. And it's like a scientific experiment there. I see it now because I'm out of it, but I still wouldn't mind going back to see it for real. You know, mm-hmm. sober mm-hmm. view of it all, you know, because when I was there, it's like you're trapped in this sort of fake paradise. But it's paradise. Believe me, it's paradise because, you know, you're free. You've got a lassie or, you know, fresh juice and, you know, the huts on the beach. And I mean, India is so precious in its in its sort of villages and women and color and the food and the level of belief and rituals and all of these things that we don't have here, but it's going to disappear. I mean, I just heard in Delhi, they're taking away their coal, and I get it. It's a smoky place, but these people are so poor. How are they going to cook their food or heat their homes or... when you live, you can't put this development in a third world country. So many will die, you know.
And we saw that, you know. I can't remember the Rothschild, her first name, but the Rothschilds, contemporary in our time, are completely responsible for the deaths of many thousands of Indian farmers because they forced them to have these GMO seeds with their Terminator gene. So, you know, farming has always been, you save your seeds, the seeds, you save them, and that is sustainable. You see what I'm saying? Yep.
I get it. See, that's what I thought it meant. Is that what
And the farmers, they understood what was being done with them, and many of them committed suicide. And that's literally on a still living Rothschild. But this is what this agenda is about. It is about standardization and the total control of everything.
Yep, it sure is. They did it, you know, in Australia too. I think that guy's name was Jeremy Lee, maybe. There's a guy, a really amazing, he's dead now, but like an Alan Watt. But anyway, when they did that Lima Accord, so in Australia, you know, back in the day, there were many, many farmers, and everybody had, I mean, they can grow their own food. Why would they be importing food? Doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But they did this thing. I don't know what year it was. Maybe it was 1992. It's called the Lima Accord. And essentially what it means is that it's not fair to third world countries that we're going to start importing to create some fairness. And then the more, of course, once they started importing from, say, Malaysia and Indonesia and Thailand, these Australian farmers couldn't compete with the price. So they went under by the hundreds of thousands of farms gone because of this whole exploitation of their own workers in their own country.
Right.
But it's done by design to impoverish Australia, because I spent time there and Canada too, and the States. We never needed to import food. We never
right.
did.
Right.
You know, and as soon as we did, then we devalued our food, because we can't compete with these cheap workers or cheaper farming. And then the food comes in at half the price. What are you going to buy, a $10 apple or a dollar apple? You're
right.
going to choose a dollar apple, you know, and then people get used to paying a dollar for an apple. But that's not the case anymore, Melissa. The food has doubled since COVID here in Canada.
It was shockingly high when I was there. And when you told me, you know, about what the prices are now, and so, you know, and a perfect example of food in Canada is fish.
Yeah.
Canada should never need fish from anywhere in the world. And their fishing industry on the East Coast was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And they decimated it. The Canadian government decimated the fisheries, mm-hmm. put them out of business intentionally. Mm-hmm. And if you go into a grocery store in Canada, the only fish that you're going to see there comes from China.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you get BC salmon, though. It is all you get Atlantic salmon. But you're
well,
right.
Yeah.
Coming from China, some of it. You're right.
Most of it. Yeah. I mean, there are exceptions. There's even a little bit of fish that you can find from the East Coast, but I would say 95 to 98% of the fish sold in Canada is from China.
You're right.
And that's just,
yeah,
it's incomprehensible. Yeah. You know, one thing that Alan used to point out about the Cold War is that the food that the Soviets needed to survive, because they had all these crazy five-year plans and the Lysenkoism, where they, you know, the crazy things they tried to do with the seeds, with, you know, because of this deranged scientist Lysenko. Well, who was feeding them? It was primarily Canada, but the U.S. also was supplying a lot of grain to the Soviet Union. So Canada, for decades, for your and into your parents' life, could not only feed their entire country. I mean, Canada's not a hugely populated place anyway, but they could feed their entire country and export a huge amount of grain. So yes, that was the state of how much grain the US and Canada could produce, so that they had no problem feeding their entire population. And that is the way that it should be. There's so many things that factor into it. I've seen some good documentaries on Britain and how they were they could produce everything they needed in terms of electronics and mechanical things and all of the food that they needed. One of the first devastations that hit them was World War I, when they lost so much of their farming manpower. You know, just the deaths of all this. So by the time that World War II came around and the men were off, I mean, even preparing the farms to bring them back up to be able to sustain your country between World War I and World War II is a huge challenge. If you think about it, you've got the family farm. Many of those family farms were now only farmed by the surviving women, the sisters, the mothers, they had to do that. So it was a huge challenge. But there was a funny movie. I think it was the mouse on the moon, the mouse that roared. I think the mouse on the moon, where they show this in a comedic fashion with all of the countries showing what they can produce. And it's this arms race in a way, you know, who's going to make the rocket to the moon. And the English show up and they had this one watch. They were bragging, you know, that was all that was left of British manufacturing.
The time.
And that is such the case in Canada now, where just like in the US, everything's been offshored.
Another point that you bring up there, it was on ideas on CBC, because I always like to listen to CBC. I want to know what they're up to. But there was this philosopher from Germany. I can't remember his name. I wish I had it written down. But he was kind of the first guy to introduce kind of formal education. But what was interesting, it happened in Germany, and his wife was someone who, they had this kind of open relationship where she would go and do salons, you know, saloons or whatever.
Was it Fichte? Was it Fichte?
Yeah, no. I'll look him up and I'll...
German philosopher on education.
He was an elite. He was...
Hold on. There goes the door, finally. Don't know what he was up to, but... Okay, so just say again, he was an elite.
Yeah. So, So he created this education system, and it was all about play for the children. It was kind of creative. It sounded all good, sort of Montessori-ish, but the farmers, they didn't want to have their men leave the farm. It was mandatory too. It became mandatory education for everyone, but the farmers needed their sons, and that's an education in itself.
To be a
farmer. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you take your children off, they may not return because they'll see other ways to make their living. They may not return to the farm, and then what happens to that farm? And I think that's all done by design. The whole education is to take the children from their parents, educate them in this uni kind of universal education. Everybody gets the same deal, and nobody really wants to go and do the real work, which is growing food, and chopping wood, keeping your house warm.
Right.
There isn't much that we really need as human beings, you know. But when you, yeah. Anyway, it was just some off story, but.
That's interesting.
When you think about, but we were talking about yoga too on the phone the other day.
Oh yes. Yes.
I did watch that little video that you put out of that you sent me of the old guru and his very young 18-year-old wife. Did you watch it? So okay.
I'm sure I did. I mean, I sent it to you, but for some reason, it's not ringing a bell. Who was the yogi?
So it was the Kundalini. So
the yoga that I did in LA.
Is that what you did, Kundalini?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was the last thing. I mean, I did. You know, I tried this and I tried that, and that was my. He was the one that introduced me, to Alan. Inadvertently, he didn't mean to, I'm sure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had a back and forth with him. Anyway, I'll just tell you the quick back and forth. I had gone to my first yoga outing in LA, and it might be a little bit different there than what you got in Canada, but the first flavor that I got, it definitely felt like a religion. And I was fresh coming out of Texas and a Christian background. And I said, oh, no. This is a religion. I'm not interested in a religion. I just wanted to do something for you know, limbering up and strength and right. So I didn't go for a while, but then after you're in LA, I mean, well, you know, the as Alan would say, we get corrupted. So I went back in and I'm like, oh, this is really cool. So the next yoga teacher I had been a student of Baba Ram Dass, and she'd hung out and, you know, she partied with Timothy Leary and blah, blah, blah. So I'm doing her classes for a while. And, you know, so I kind of floated around doing different classes. And sometimes I wouldn't do yoga for a while. But the last outing that I had was that guru. And for some reason, I can't think of his name now, Khalsa. It doesn't matter. Anyway, yeah. So, but he had left. See, he was the yogi for and Kundalini is like, that's the hot thing for the LA crowd, you know, Demi Moore, you name it, they're all doing that. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, but that guy, he and Russell Brand is a student of his. So, I'm in good company, right? What a creep he is. What does that say about me? Anyway, I'm in a class with him. And it was huge because it was very popular. And he was always bashing Republicans, always bashing the right, the conservatives. So I sent him an email one night and I said, why are you always bashing the conservatives, the Republicans? Can't you see that there's no difference between what they do and what the Democrats are doing? Well, he sent me back an email, and all he sent was a link to the dialectic. I had never heard of the dialectic. And so I'm reading this going, wow, that's really interesting. And then a little bit later, he sent me an email and he gave me a link to Alex Jones.
Oh, yeah.
And David Icke. And I mean, there's a little bit of poking fun at myself because I started with Alex Jones, I believe.
Yeah.
And so I was telling everyone who would listen, I probably listened to him for 3 or 4 weeks, you know, but I mean, intensely.
Yeah.
And so I was telling everyone, 9/11 was an inside job, you know. Yeah, I mean, just like crazy. Whatever he said, I was going, you know, oh yeah. And then I got into Icke. That one didn't last quite as long, but for probably a couple of weeks, I was just, you know, absorbing everything that I could of David Icke. And then I proposed to a friend of mine that it was possible that the royal family were shape-shifting lizards. I said, because look at, yeah, no, I mean, I make fun of myself now, but there was obviously something in my head that was kind of opening up to seeing things from a different perspective. And then probably about a week later, that same yoga teacher sent me a Red Eyes radio link. And he said, there are a lot of interesting things here. And so I spent, again, like a week just, oh, I'll listen to this on Red Eyes and I'll listen to that. And then I stumbled on Alan Watt, the very first thing that he had. It was like that he had just done it. There it was, Alan's first conversation with Henrique on Red Eyes.
Yeah. Where was that?
I think the first one was late 2006. I started communicating with Alan at the beginning of 2007. But for me, that was it. Like, okay, I'm not doing yoga anymore. And everything, it was, you know, all Alan all the time. I confess, I'm a bit of a zealot.
But, you know, I've been to LA. I've done some LA yoga. The one thing that I found really bizarre was that Bikram character, okay?
Because I've been to Bikram.
And I just remember going, so he took me when I went to LA, we went almost every day, and he took me into this room and it had carpet. And here were these beautiful people, like all models or actors, and it just stunk. Like it was so dirty. And I said, going on? I mean, this is disgusting. Like, how I pass out, you know? It really with carpet. I didn't understand. And also it was boring. It's the same 24 poses over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's because I'm trained. Like, I've got my certification, my 500 hour, but I've studied with many of the great teachers. And this is what I always see. It's always method based. You know, it's always a series. It's always a man. And always, every time they get to be so big, something comes out where they've taken advantage of their students. It's always the same story. And I just did like a half a training in Peterborough back in 2000. And then a teacher came from Italy to do a little workshop for us. And it's when I met her that I realized that whatever I was doing before wasn't, it was method, you know. This was expansive because it was feminine. So it was interesting because not that anybody thought I would be a great teacher, but when they saw how I fell for Diane, they said, oh my goodness, we've lost Suzanne. Because that work that I do now, which, you know, it's not on a method. It's not about the scriptures. It's not about a religion. It's really about a practice. Like, you kind of mentioned to me that you do stretching now. Well, I do a practice. I wouldn't even call it yoga because it's all about the breathing. And Diane was a student of, I told you about Wanda Scaravalli, who was this aristocrat from Italy who studied with BKS Iyengar in Italy in her 50s. And also knew Krishnamacharya, who was the kind of father of yoga. He taught, like, Krishnamacharya taught Iyengar, he taught Bikram, he taught Patavi Joyce, Ashtanga. He taught all of them. Oh, and his son is another guy, but it doesn't matter. What I'm trying to say is, you know, he ended up, he taught all these schools for different reasons. One was for the lungs. Another was, it was all broken into pieces. And once Wanda had kind of figured out all the pieces and put them all together, she left them all and said, I don't need you. I don't need a teacher anymore. I can be my own teacher, you know. This is the thing that I see with yoga. Because I've tried to teach. I mean, I did teach for a few years, is that everyone is so ambitious. It's like they think it's going to take them to some end if they can do the splits or a backbend or something fancy. It's fast. It's lost, you know, because of what you've discussed on your show many times, the whole class system in India and what yoga was really designed, really was for soldiers. And it was designed for young men, like gymnastics almost, designed for the population like it is now in the West, where it's become a commodity.
Well, it's an interesting thing. And I think, you know, that Alan certainly gave me a different perspective. I mean, when I say, you know, I discovered him and then I quit doing it, I mean, it really kind of was that black and white for me, but it was just sort of that way with everything. You know, I came onto his work and then I just embarked on wanting to look at myself and all of the choices that I had made for my whole life. And so part of it was going cold turkey with everything. It's like one of the first conversations that I had with Alan, you know, he'd talked to me long enough to just make this assessment, which I didn't care for at all. But he said, well, you're just a composite of all your indoctrination. And I'm like, well, thank you very much. You know, but it was true. I mean, I was able to, you know, kind of sit with that, so to speak, for a while and realize, well, that is true. I don't really know myself. And, you know, I am my hobbies, my things that I say that I like to do have all more or less been given to me. So it was seeing yoga in a different way. He also sent me I've covered some of them. None of them do I have in my head at the moment, but different documentaries and books that had been done about yoga that showed it from a different perspective. But my concern, like if I talk about New Age or we talk about theosophy and so forth, is that much of the reason why it was brought to the West had nothing to do with physical training or limbering you up and so forth. It really was brought here to be a part of a new religion, part of what Blavatsky and Annie Besant and all of those theosophicals were doing was, how do we introduce even the Beatles going down to India? This was part of that. How do we bring in parts of Hinduism that we think are helpful to control? We, the elite, are helpful to control and introduce that to the Western mind. Another thing that Alan pointed out to me, and this is, it's just an interesting thing I mentioned to you on the phone, was that certain schools, and I don't know if this was in the origination of yoga or if it was something that was hijacked later in its history, was that the asanas, each of the, and I don't want to say each of the asanas, but some of the asanas were literally positions that you could put yourself in that were to facilitate the calling down of a god entity or a demonic entity. Let's just say an entity that had certain powers, that if you could bring that entity into you, then it would bring you certain powers. And this is true. I mean, I've heard people talk about Kabbalah in a favorable light, and I'm not going to say black or white here.
Yeah,
but there are, because this is, I think, a potential that exists in any religious idea or school of thought. Well, I think anything can be perverted, but I mean, what I'm saying is, it's very clear that people have used some of these traditions for power or to try to obtain power, and that even includes bringing in an entity or attempting to bring in an entity. And this, I mean, we don't have time to go into, you know, John Dee and all of that, but at the roots of these are potentials that can be quite harmful. And this is unfortunate because, you know, anything can also contains with it a possibility for good. I was listening to, you know, James Tunney, and you may not be familiar with him, but I've listened to a few of his talks, and he was discussing with Jeffrey Mishlove in an interview. They were talking about Kabbalah, yoga, different things, and he was talking about how something could be used as a pathway to higher consciousness. And not to be black and white. And I know where Tunney is coming from. There's a huge Catholic background there and a lot of respect for Christianity and Catholicism in particular. But it concerns me when people are too dogmatic or black and white in their thinking, like that's all bad and you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Because Christianity, I would say that Christianity itself has been so diluted and perverted since the original message. I'm not sure that I got where I was going there, but okay. The way of Alan Watt.
Yeah.
The way of Alan Watt was so beautiful because it is putting everything on the individual. Hmm. The choices that you make, the path that you take, and ultimately being responsible for yourself, even to have him point out you are just a composite of your indoctrination, your hobbies, the things that you do, the yoga, the baking, whatever, these things have been given to you. So you have to examine yourself closely and see what is helpful to you in overcoming the personality that has been given to you.
Yes. Well, that's another reason why I left Canada too, in a way, because if you're alone, your personality goes with you, but you can, you think you can escape your personality by going away, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
But the reality is, no, you really can't. And the thing, because I have been around the whole yoga community for a long time, and I do yoga shows every year because I sell my yoga wear. But what I've seen is this word kindness, which really gets on my nerves, because it's this sort of spaced outlook that yoga is going to take care of everything, and that you can actually meditate your way into a good world.
Okay, here it is. I had a costume change, but I was interrupted. And so that allowed me to change shirts while I dealt with an issue that was going on here at the house. But I wanted to get back to the train of thought that I was having there. I had been listening to the Jeffrey Mishlov interview of James Tunney, and I've talked about him before. His work was introduced to me by Andrea, actually, on the Telegram channel. And I won't be able to let you know which interview this was because there are a lot of them, and he touches on some similar things in them. And he did a big series with Mishlov. But the point that he was making is that if you are seeking higher consciousness, if this is what you're going to head to, which you could call, I don't want to call it a substitute for a religion, because all religions really at the root are about transcendence. They are about that higher consciousness. But he said the approach is best if you are coming from within your own tradition. And so one thing that was beautiful about Alan and his work was that he was not dogmatic. He showed you the truth of the system. He told you to look at yourself, to look at the man or the woman in the mirror, to take responsibility. He would say things like, you don't go to heaven in a posse. In other words, it's an individual thing. So it just happened that when I was listening to Alan before I met him, I could see where he was coming from, and I wasn't wrong. I had a certain vocabulary, but I'm like, oh, it's mystical Jesus. You know, I felt that he was able to express the very highest of something that I had come out of. And you know, this made him laugh when I told him, but I said, you know, I was raised a Christian around Christians, and I felt like I never even knew one until I heard you speak. Because, and Alan has touched on these things mostly by his reading and discussion of the work of Carl Jung, but he has talked about the idea that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You have to go into it anew for yourself. And I think that in terms of the Blavatsky Theosophy introduction of a system that had its roots, and you're talking about India and going there and seeing how old this culture was and how important these traditions were to them. And it's within each culture, and this is not an ecumenical statement that all religions are the same or, you know, none are, that's not what I'm saying. But within all cultures, there are openings for people who are seeking something that is not confined to the material world. that doesn't take its answers in, you know, this is all, you know, the Darwinistic evolution that, well, this is where we are. We're just animals. We're just another animal, like, you know, because we can see where that leads us, where that takes us. So that was my big, long aside. These were the things that I had gone into yoga. I think initially, yes, it was just stretching and so forth. But once I got that, you know, as Alan would say, that corrupted thing, then I did begin to seek some of the answers that I had been seeking for my whole life in the framework of yoga as religion. And that was never your path. So it was very interesting for me to talk to you. You had always approached it from making your body the best that it could be.
You got it. Well, I don't know. I mean, some people can be brainwashed.
Yes.
You really see it in the yoga world. They get that glossed over look. It's very strange when there was this other guy, John Friend, he did this Anusapana.
Yes, yes.
And I just remember being at the yoga show one year, and he was there, and his, I guess you call them his disciples, were there.
Yes.
And they were young girls, you know, 18 to 30, beautiful, but very glossy-eyed. And I thought, who is this person? And then he was talking about spirals and tricks. They're just tricks, really. I mean, when you delve deep into a practice of breathing and of stretching, you discover all these things yourself. It's, you know, you begin to see how the muscles move. It's just really trying to understand your body. That's all it is trying to understand the anatomy of your body and making your body pain-free. That was it. Because my dad, like I said, he was in chronic pain my whole life. But he decided he was never going to do pain pills. He was never going to, he never wanted to be outside of his body. So he always was looking for answers within. Mm-hmm. And he taught me that. And I think it's valuable to, it's your own journey, like you say. And you don't need a guru to lead you to some kind of nirvana experience. You know, and I see this a lot now. There's all these retreats and people are microdosing and they're, you know, they just want to feel good. And the reality is, I think they're so anxious because their jobs are stressful. Their lives are stressful. You know, women now are doing two things. They're mothering and they're working. And they just want to escape it a little bit, find a little bit of happiness.
Just a little bit of LSD. Just a little bit of psilocybin. just a pinch.
If you're not going to macrodose, there's just no point. I mean, this whole idea of having to medicate yourself, really. And it is. These people are medicating daily with these microdosing. And I just think,
that's sad.
You know, and they're young and they're healthy.
You said Kundalini, and that really was my last, you know, before I escaped LA. And I sound like there's this whole interchange with him, but I think I only probably went to 6, maybe 8 of his classes because looking back on it now, I feel that the whole point of that, and his name did pop into my head, it was Hari Jawan.
Okay.
Yeah. So you see, there's pictures of the Hari Jawan and Russell Brand. But anyway, that was him. And he was the same idea with the glassy eyed, you know, young girls and that kind of thing. And I felt like it was that whole experience was just so that I could go into his class, be a little off put by it. Because the very first thing that came in, you know, with the Kundalini, at least the way that he was doing it, you do these breath exercises, which is nothing more than almost like the whirling dervish kind of thing. But it's nothing more than trying to make yourself dizzy.
Yeah.
It's about putting your mind in an altered state simply by putting so much breath in there that you're about to, you know what I mean? So there was that going on, and I thought to myself after the first class, this is an ideal setup for mind control with this kind of breath technique. And then it was like the second or third class that I emailed him and had to say, you know, why are you bashing on about the conservatives? And that really did lead me to Alan, which I have to be forever grateful to the Hari Jawan for that. You know, so that was the thing, is that I think a lot of people going into it aren't looking for making, you know, the physical exercise and the stretching and the limbering and getting free of pain and all that. They are looking for a mind altering. They're looking for someone to say this way. And unfortunately, in the yoga world, just like so many other, you could even see this in Christian with the mega pastors. It's a, you know, come here, worship me, or, you know, I'm God's man on earth.
Immortality aspect to it too, that I was really into that at one point. I believe we're all immortal, you know? And so, you know, especially when you're in Goa and you're kind of, you know, partying and, you know, you feel like there's so much more to us than what we're given. You know, because we're, from the day we're three or four, we're put in front of a chair and we're told to listen, you know, and then we forget who we are. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then lots of problems start, you know. You've got most jobs now, people are just sitting all day, you know, and mm-hmm. they're in pain. You know, mm-hmm. you think, oh yeah, you're making lots of money, but there's a big sacrifice. And so yoga can serve that part of it, you know?
Right.
But it's really lost what I think it, and it is a religion a little bit, you know, it is, because there isn't just the poses. There's all the doctrine that goes with it.
Right.
And it is mostly at a high level of caste that would even have the time to do it, you know. And there's this whole step into a Hindu's life. The top mm-hmm. of it is to give up your family at the end once
yes.
you've served it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's to give it up and then to become a sadhu and just reach nirvana, you know. And it's a lie. I realize it's not true. It's the most important thing is your family. And just to sort of finish off, because I know we've been talking a long time, is I'm living in my mother's home right now because my beloved mother, my Austrian, gorgeous 90-year-old mother, has stage 4 cancer. And we as a family, so my brother and sister are here and me, we've moved a hospital bed in our home, and we're going to take care of our mom till the end. And I think that is the highest thing we can do. And I think, in a way, yoga has prepared me to do this work, you know, because I'm strong and I'm limber. I can handle it. It's heavy work. It's very demanding work.
Yeah.
And it's so rewarding, you know. And as Alan said, that now people aren't getting married, they're not having kids. And that is the family, you're with your brother, you know, you're lucky. Some people don't have that. And that is what glues us together. That's what brings community. That's what brings us happiness, is that connection that we have to one another, you know?
Well, we did, that's what happened here. And, you know, my brother, before I came home from Canada, you know, my father had been ill for a number of years, and I was here for the last 6 months of his life. So I would say that my brother had done the heavy lifting, the youngest one. But we were all here with a hospital bed. All three of my brothers were surrounding my father, who was able to pass at home. Beautiful. And it was really great. And, you know, I was grateful that, you know, it wasn't just the yoga, but the chopping wood and stacking wood and the whole thing physically, because it is very demanding. Very demanding. And there is something that about death, that we are so separated. And Alan talked about this a lot, as you know, that we have removed that. We want to sanitize the death experience. So when people reach a certain age, we put them in a nursing facility or long-term care, and they die, and then somebody else handles it. And when you are at the end of someone's life, you see these things. And I'll hear from people who are like, well, why are you not in favor of assisted dying, you know, assistance in dying? And for a lot of reasons, I think it's a slippery slope. I think that that families, especially good families, have always known how to deal in the end. And there are a lot, and always have been, things that will help people that are in pain. And I know here that the hospice that brought the hospital bed and everything, they're very quick to tell you, and here is XYZ drug, and, you know, don't hesitate to use it. And my father just passed pretty peacefully. But what I'm saying is that without going that assisted suicide way, there are a lot of supports actually out there that allow your loved ones to die at home relatively pain-free when it comes down to those final hours. And it's something, I wouldn't trade that experience of having been there in the last 6 months of my father's life. And it was hard, you know, to help someone who eventually can't get out of bed, and you're bathing him. And my brother and I mean, sometimes we were changing the sheets 2 and 3 times a day. Yeah. And he's wearing, you know, pull-ups. And these hard facts of, like, people like, oh, I don't want to deal with that. But, you know, this is the man that raised me. And he changed my diaper, I'm sure, I don't know how many times. So, you know, to be able to give that back, it is priceless. And to see the circle of life, not to be too, you know, Disney about it.
But it is. And, you know, the thing is my mother's so appreciative. I've never seen someone appreciate. And the fact that I get along with my brother and sister, and that we all love each other. And we know we will continue as a family going on, you know. Yeah. And that is just... well, there's so much dignity in that, isn't there? I mean, that's what it is. It's dignity.
That is, and they all, you know, the people who want to push out the agenda and all of the agenda's techniques on us and make us embrace it and demand it. They're always talking about dignity and dying, dignity and dying. No, yeah. Dignity and dying is when you can be with your family.
Yeah.
And they love you, or you're able to do that. And I know not everybody has that kind of family. And, you know, it's the dysfunction in society is very sad. But I think that even overcoming that to the best that you can and saying, I'm going to show up for this. I'm going to be here.
If you can, you know, not everybody can. Not everybody has a home that can have that, you know, a bed in there and enough people to house it, you know. But one thing that was interesting, though, just closing here, is the hospitals now in Canada, and the system is very broken.
Yes.
The care was amazing. The nurses, amazing. The doctors, amazing. But we've gone to 3 different hospitals to have 3 different procedures done, and there's no communication among the doctors. So it's very frustrating. And for my mom, you know, it's heartbreaking a little bit. And also, I went there a couple days ago just to see if we forgot anything, because my mom had to be hospitalized for a bit. And it was on lockdown because there was an outbreak, and I wouldn't have been able to even see my mom if I wanted to. So we just got her out in time, and there's no way I want to put her back there, knowing they could lock us down again and not see her, you know. That's very painful to see.
Yeah, when Alan was in the hospital in 2016, it was a little bit different experience. I did find that the nursing care was quite good. But I also felt that they were very regimented in the time that I don't know if you experienced this, they were all good, but it was literally like time and motion studies going on. Yeah. The doctors were a mixed bag, because he ended up being, they didn't know what was wrong with him. He ended up having 3 things at one time. It was hard to diagnose. Overall, I would say 3 of the 4 doctors were quite good.
Yeah.
The fourth, both Alan and I were convinced that he only existed to try to kill Alan. I mean, it was a nightmare.
It's possible.
But they were good. It was good in that I said to the hospital, I am not leaving his side. Yeah. He was in an isolation room. So they came in with all their hazmat stuff on because they didn't know and you know what was wrong with him. And so the infectious disease ward. So it's all very controlled. But I said, no, you'll have to set up some kind of cot or bed or something because I'm not leaving here. Oh. And they were very accommodating. They were very accommodating. So,
which it would be different now, maybe. And another thing too is they're short of nurses, and yet they have these hiring freezes, so they can't hire anyone, and they're short. That part I don't understand. Like those nurses are run off their feet, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of tragic.
But, well, even pre-COVID in 2016, I saw that too. You could tell that they were understaffed. It was just ridiculous. But overall, I mean, I think, you know, in the U.S., a lot of people look with longing to Canada and say, we need to have socialized medicine and it's a much better system. And it's like, no, there are problems there, too. I mean, the U.S. has a lot of problems, but there are problems there, too. But that was one thing that impressed me was the nursing staff was they were caring, which is what you want in a nurse. That's a good thing. I did a clothing change because I wanted to show off a funky Buddha.
Oh, that's the one I gave you.
Yes.
I didn't notice.
So this is my funky Buddha wrap. And it is, I don't know if I stand up, if you'll be able to see it all. I don't know, but it is a wrap. Can you see that?
Yay.
Yeah. And it's very comfortable. It's actually, today is the first really cold day that we've had. It did a snap and it's going to be cold, which will be fun because for Thanksgiving, we can make a little fire in the fireplace, which unfortunately it's not like the whole system, you know, in Texas, fireplaces are kind of like something you put a few logs in and you have a show fire. They don't really heat the house, which is too bad. No, I'd like someday if I could ever afford it to do like either put a wood burning stove in there in the opening or an insert that would actually heat the house properly. But we don't, you know, fortunately, we don't have that many super cold days. So that's kind of like a luxury thing. A luxury item. A wood burning stove is a luxury item, but I do have some wood. I had a tree cut down at my aunt's house earlier, and so that was good. So I am so happy that we got to do this. I think for those of you who are listening, I hope that this was a cheerful way for you to spend Thanksgiving if you're in the U.S. and you wanted a break from, you know, if there's dysfunction in your family and you got into a major fight over the pie, then this might be a nice break.
Or bake a pie, you know, bake a pie. And happy Thanksgiving to all the most beautiful Americans and their families. I hope you feast on the best food this year and that you celebrate by loving each other and, you know, helping each other when you need to, you know, especially when, you know, when someone's sick or unwell. You know, to try to be there for them if you can.
I am so glad that you are there with your mother and that your brother and sister are there. And I give you a big heart hug,
It's what a pleasure.
So keep nice.
Keep doing what you're doing.
And I, hold on a second. Sorry. I'm trying to sign off now. So what I wanted to say is that next week I am talking to Prince. I did a real history with him in the spring. I just love him to bits. He is 75, a retired chef, lives in Las Vegas, Nevada, gardens and goes to the gym, and he's just great. And so I'll be talking to him again next week. And I just, love you all. I said it last week. The cat's out of the bag. I love you guys. All right. Take care. And I am going to sign off.
my father.